It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up in just a few moments, we'll look at congressional reaction to disclosures about President Trump's release of classified information to Russia and a controversial memo from ousted FBI Director James Comey.
First, WPR reporter Rich Kramer has been at the site of the tornado that touched down in Barron County just north of Chautauqua last night, and he's with us now for the latest. Rich, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Rich, one person tragically died last night, and at least 25 more were injured. What do we know about their condition?
Well, we know that one person of the 25 injured has been upgraded to serious condition. His family, it was a grandfather, the family said that he is actually in critical condition. He was flown by helicopter to a hospital in St. Paul with injuries to his neck, broken ribs, and just severe trauma, also a head injury. The person that died was a 45-year-old man that reportedly worked the night shift and may have been sleeping right through the storm, and he was found outside of his trailer, which was completely destroyed.
Do we know which parts of Barron County were hit the hardest?
Well, it's the Prairie Lake Estates, basically, and that's towards the southern eastern edge of Barron County, just 3 miles north of Chautauqua. It's really amazing. You drive up to the site on one of the local highways, and there's no damage whatsoever to trees or anything, but then it seems like there's a quarter mile wide path of destruction. I hate to sound cliche, but everything in the path is completely devastated. Trees are snapped in half. The tops of the trees are just gone. It looks like a bomb went off, and there's just about the bottom half of the tree is just standing. It's very strange, just really amazing damage, and it's been really tough to listen to hear to what these families have gone through. I was at the Red Cross triage unit that they've set up nearby in the city of Cameron, and a lot of folks with bandages on their face, lots of stitches. It was really an awful storm.
And you reported last night that residents were hoping to be let back in soon to assess the damage and search and rescue some of their belongings. Did that happen today?
At 1 o'clock, the sheriff started letting families back in to assess the damage. They were kind of congregating at Mosaic Telecom, which is the local internet provider here in Chautauqua. That's also where the Red Cross is situated. But they've just been slowly, between 1 and 8 p.m. tonight, I guess, they're letting the families back in to see what's left. But there's really not much left. A lot of the, there was aerial footage from a news chopper out of the Twin Cities yesterday that showed a lot of the homes are just gone, just completely gone. And there's mobile homes that were picked up and placed on top of each other. There's not much left. There's a few trailers that seem to be standing, but the owner of the park told me that those are not inhabitable right now.
You said it was hard to hear these stories and see the injuries on some of these survivors. Did they tell you what it was like living through this storm?
Yes. One family, it was a husband and wife and their two kids were in their trailer, and they said there was no warning. It got real dark, and they heard sirens coming from Chautauqua, which is, again, 3 miles away. But other than that, there was no warning. And the wind that came out of nowhere, trees were bent over sideways. What this woman told me that her roof and her walls were ripped off of the house. She tried to push her son under a table, and she tried to lie on top of him, but she was struck by part of the roof on her neck. She was wearing a neck brace. And she said she looked up and she saw a gray swirling cloud pass over. And her husband was saying that he was getting hit with golf ball size hail because the roof was gone. So, and then another woman mentioned that she was trying to watch the storm. She didn't realize how bad it was going to be. And she watched the neighboring trailer get picked up, and she was watching all kinds of debris and sheds swirling overhead. And she too was, she was buried under a wall that had collapsed on her and had some torn ligaments and muscles. But of the families that I've spoken with, they were not involved with the fatality.
Well, that sounds unbelievable going through that. And Rich, going forward, what kind of support is there for those who were affected sometimes in drastic ways by the storm?
It's been really overwhelming, actually. The sheriff said that the support has been overwhelming. Red Cross is here. I was basically writing up my stories for the network at the Red Cross Center, the mobile or the Mosaic Telecom building. There's dozens of Red Cross volunteers here. They've got clothes for children, clothes for adults, food. There was a few people that stayed overnight at the shelter. Outside of the trailer park, there was a group from a local church that was there to offer pastoral support. And a lot of, I believe there's some counseling people, too, to help with some of the grief when people are let back in.
Rich, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Rich Kramer, WPR reporter based in Eau Claire, and he's been covering the tornado that hit Barron County yesterday. Stay tuned to Wisconsin Public Radio and WPR.org for continuing coverage.
Now, members of Congress are reacting to the big stories about the Trump administration over the last 2 days. On Monday, a story broke that President Trump had revealed classified information to Russian officials, which the president appeared to confirm on Twitter the next day.
And last night, there were reports of a memo written by ousted FBI Director James Comey, in which he said the president had asked him to end an investigation into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn.
Reactions in Congress have ranged from calls for impeachment to defense of the president and all points in between. Paul Singer joins us now, Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's look at this newest big story, the one that came out last night. What is the importance of this release, or not release, but this news about the existence of this memo by James Comey?
Well, the importance is, I think, for starters, that we now have a piece of paper that Congress wants. James Comey apparently was documenting his conversations with President Trump. And these conversations, it appears Comey believed they were going a little off track, and so he wanted to keep track and write down what was happening. The indications from the memo that Comey was writing are that Mr. Trump might have asked him to drop the investigation of Mike Flynn, because Michael Flynn, the NSA, briefly, National Security Advisor, was obviously under investigation for his connection to Russia and also to Turkey. Now, the Trump administration says that it's misinterpreted, or it's not exactly what the conversation was about. But remember that Trump last week had tweeted to James Comey, "Careful what you say, because I may have tapes of it." So today, the Republicans who run the Oversight Committee and the Judiciary Committee are asking for documents. They want copies of these Comey memos from the Justice Department, and they want copies of any tapes from the White House. This guarantees that for the next several weeks at least, there's going to be a drip, 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 drip of stories about the process of this investigation and Republicans in Congress trying to extract documents from the White House.
Let's give a listen to House Speaker Paul Ryan reacting to this story and the Russia story and more. Here's a listen.
We need the facts. It is obvious there are some people out there who want to harm the president, but we have an obligation to carry out our oversight regardless of which party is in the White House. And that means before rushing to judgment, we get all the pertinent information. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee has appropriately requested this memo, and I'm sure we're going to want to hear from Mr. Comey about why, if this happens as he allegedly describes, why didn't take action at the time?
So 3 points there from the speaker. People out there want to harm the president. Why didn't James Comey take action at the time? Let's not rush to judgment. Is this kind of the main mainstream line from Republicans in the House?
Well, honestly, the mainstream line from Republicans in the House is all over the place. It's not. I mean, the basic line we're getting is let's wait and see what all this says. I mean, I think in fairness to everybody involved in this, and particularly to the politicians involved with this, we just don't know, and no one's seen these memos. They've been read to our reporters. Our reporters have been able to confirm that they exist. No one's actually seen them. So until we actually see what Mr. Comey claims President Trump told him, And until we see some sort of defense mounted from President Trump, it's hard to know exactly what we're dealing with here. I mean, at the far edge, if Mr. Trump directly contacted the director of the FBI and said, stop investigating me and this guy, that is potentially obstruction of justice. But it's a long way from here, which is a news story or two describing these memos, to the point of being able to make the legal conclusion that the President of the United States broke the law.
I want to give a listen to Senator John McCain now. He used the phrase Watergate speaking at an event. This was last night.
I think it's reaching the point where it's of Watergate size and scale and a couple of other scandals that you and I have seen. It's a centipede that the shoe continues to drop. And every couple of days, there's a new aspect of this really unhappy situation.
Senator McCain has referred to that centipede with all the shoes dropping a few times now. But is that what it's feeling like, especially for Republicans in Congress, the sense of this bad thing and now what's going to happen?
Yeah, that's what it feels like for the reporters in Washington. I mean, you know, 6 o'clock every night, there's another barn burner story suggesting that, you know, something else going wrong in the White House. The problem for the Republicans is that they can't get any of their other agenda items to the top. I mean, this morning, Paul Ryan attempted to open his press conference with Republican leaders talking about how they're going to do a tax reform bill. And then Ryan takes the podium and he gets 4 or 5 questions about, you know, should we or should we not impeach the President of the United States, and then he closes down the press conference. You know, I mean, everything else is on the back burner now. This is the only thing that matters. It's the only conversation we're going to be having for quite a while. There is a tax reform hearing tomorrow. I'm not enthusiastic it's going to get a lot of traction because at the moment, nobody in Congress has any real drive to engage with the president on any particular issue. Because all they want to know is, what did you say to James Comey? It's going to drown out everything else.
Paul Singer is with us from USA Today, looking at the latest news from Washington, including mainly congressional reaction to the James Comey memo, info sharing with Russia, and more.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from Congress on these issues? What do you want to hear from your representative? And do you want to see a special prosecutor, maybe a select committee or impeachment proceedings? Or do you think these stories are maybe overblown and Congress should just move on? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we continue our conversation now with Paul Singer from USA Today, looking at the latest reaction to the two big stories that broke this week about President Trump's apparent disclosure of intelligence info to Russian officials and about James Comey's memo.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to this steady drumbeat of news? Is the media being unfair to the president? Should Congress be doing more when it comes to oversight of President Trump? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Paul, I want to give a listen. Representative Al Green, a Democrat from Texas, speaking on the House floor today.
I rise today, Mr. Speaker, to call for the impeachment of the President of the United States of America for obstruction of justice.
People may be a little slower to throw around the I word than Representative Green, but are more people, I assume mainly Democrats, are more people starting to talk about this in Washington?
More than I would have given credence to a week ago. I mean, you know, we have been getting this. There's a funny thing about American politics, of course, is that, you know, as soon as the President of the United States takes office the next day, some of the fringy people in the opposing party will be saying, he should be impeached for, you know, whatever. So we've been getting that, plenty of that. The thing is, you know, impeachment's a pretty high bar. You need to actually commit some sort of significant crimes and misdemeanors and you know, apologies to Congressman Green. That hasn't been proven yet, obviously. We're a long way from that. But I will say that there has been more serious conversation, or at least serious sort of rumination about, could these be impeachable offenses if they are true? That's where you get to an actual serious conversation now going on in Washington, there are members of Congress, even Republican members of Congress, who have indicated that, look, if it is true that he tried to shut down an FBI investigation, if it is true that he has mishandled classified information in the White House, those could be impeachable offenses. So it is moving from the era of sort of fringy, oh, let's impeach the president, to an actual meaningful conversation about, has the president broken some rules with either, and it would have to be, remember, intent, not just carelessness, to really be a crime, and that's where you're going to get to the particularly challenging part of any kind of discussion about impeachment.
Bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
It never ceases to amaze me day by day here as another crisis comes up like this, and we're all shocked at how can this happen? What is happening? I can't believe this. Well, we shouldn't be surprised or shocked because a good percentage of the American people knew that we elected a guy for president that has no experience, is unstable, and if we could expect anything from this guy, it was going to be chaos and destruction. And it seems like every day it's another thing, and we tend to be shocked by it. We talk about impeachment and stuff like that. I don't know. I don't want to see the guy go, not being a Democrat. I mean, at least he's keeping the Republican Party locked up and tied up where they can't get anything done. If we get rid of him, maybe Mike Pence will get some of his crazy stuff done. I just can't believe it. And, you know, I've come to the point, I'm not mad at Trump. You know, some people are angry at him. Trump is who he is. Trump is Trump.
Michael, I want to jump in and bring Paul Singer on this. Michael said, hey, working as designed, he knew this was what we'd get. We should stop being shocked about being shocked.
Right. Well, Michael has an excellent point here that I think we have to be careful with our distinctions, right? I mean, it is true. All along it was true that Mr. Trump, as a candidate, called it sort of his calling card that he has no experience in Washington, he's an outsider, he doesn't know how this stuff works. So some of this may be rookie mistakes, but there is also this question of whether President Trump has given sufficient concern for the rules that still apply. The fact of the matter is there are rules for the President of the United States to play by, and they're not just polite company kind of rules, they're actually laws. And that's where the distinction is going to come between somebody who is a sort of bull, you know, I want to be a bull in a china shop, I want to shake stuff up, I want to change stuff around. You know, God bless you for that. But there are reasons that there are three branches of government, each entrusted with certain powers, and you can't just decide that the rule book doesn't apply at all to you. And I think Michael's right that we did elect a guy who we knew was going to try and shake stuff up, but there are limits even on that.
I want to give a listen to President Trump speaking today at the Coast Guard Academy commencement ceremony, saying, when you meet adversity, Coast Guard graduates rise above it. And then he got into his own story a bit. Here it is.
Never, ever, ever give up. Things will work out just fine. Look at the way I've been treated lately, especially by the media. No politician in history, and I say this with great surety, has been treated worse or more unfairly. You can't let them get you down. You can't let the critics and the naysayers get in the way of your dreams.
So sticking with President Trump's message, media treating him unfairly, and that's the story here, not the thing that the stories are about.
Yeah, you know, there's a series of adult words that I don't use on the radio to describe that kind of stuff, that it is very, very easy to. I mean, this is a politician speaking here who accuses the free press of the United States of America of being the enemy of the people. The fact of the matter is he doesn't like the stories. And he doesn't like the stories, in part because the stories show him doing things that he shouldn't be doing. And if it was all fiction, if it was all fake news, if it was being treated unfairly, there is no reason on earth that the Republican chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee would be sending him a letter saying, I'd like all the documents and all the tapes from your conversations with FBI Director Comey. I mean, the fact of the matter is there is some kind of there. We have not accused him of a crime because we don't know that there is a crime, but we are, the press is disclosing his interactions with people that appear to be beyond the pale of what the President of the United States should be doing. That's on him, not on us.
Let's bring on another caller now. Fred is with us in Westby. Fred, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, as I was telling your call screener, I just feel like this is a smokescreen on part of both political parties to keep legitimacy when it's, you know, public sentiment's at an all-time high. We're dissatisfied with both points. I'm an independent. I never bought into the two-party, you know, Coke-Pepsi system you guys have set up here. Your callers, you know, you're both representative of a, you know, just completely ideologue, like, dogmatic perspective. There's no pragmatism or will to move things forward in the nation from either political party. I can't wait till you're gone. Either of you, you need to get real jobs. Learn to hang sheetrock. Thank you.
All right. Fred, I think that was an attack on the political parties and those who talk about them in the media as well, Paul.
Yeah, well, you know, I'd be happy to hang sheetrock. I do that on the weekends from time to time. But the fact of the matter is that, and this is one of the things that worries me, right, is that people declare, oh, a pox on all your houses, you know, the media is fixed, everyone's corrupt, it's all rigged. You know, if that's your feeling, don't waste your time calling a radio station to say that we're all idiots. Go down to your local county board, get yourself registered to vote, organize some of your friends, and get out and do something about it. I mean, the nice thing about democracy is that you don't have to complain about the choices. You can go ahead and offer new choices. Love to have you in the field. And as a reporter, love to write about a qualified candidate who joins the field, no matter what their party affiliation, even if it's none. Keep in mind, Bernie Sanders was not really a Democrat until he started running for president as a Democrat. So, you know, it is not just a two-party system thing here.
We'll leave it there for now, Paul. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob. Be well.
You too. That's Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today. The 2016 election brought a lot of attention to rural communities and rural voters in the United States, and in Wisconsin in particular, where swings in those communities helped carry the state for Donald Trump.
But even though we use those terms a lot, it's less common to actually think about or define what the term rural means.
A new report looking at that issue in Wisconsin was released today by WisContext in conjunction with the Applied Population Laboratory at UW-Madison. That report is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Malia Jones is the lead author on the study. She's a social epidemiologist with the Applied Population Lab. She studies segregation and its health consequences. Malia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So, yeah, I was thinking about this. You think rural and a picture pops in your head and you think you know what it means until you start trying to define it. That's where it gets tricky, isn't it?
It is tricky. So we started writing this report based on the various official designations of what rural places are and what urban places are, and also some unofficial definitions.
Let's look at some of those official definitions of rural. What are some of the most widely used ones when it comes to, you know, setting public policy in this country?
So probably the most common one comes from the U.S. Census Bureau, and it's known as urbanized places or urbanized areas. And it really delineates, based on population density, and it really delineates the areas that are urbanized or cities from places that are not urbanized, which are everything else is classified as rural. And so these are really developed land areas.
So rural equals not urban in this
That's
definition.
Right. And in fact, in the second most common definition, that's the same story. The Office of Management and Budget does the metropolitan and micropolitan statistical areas, which are also city definitions, and then the remainder of places are considered rural.
So how does Wisconsin fall into those categories? How much of us, how much of our state is considered urban versus rural by these measures?
So compared to other states, Wisconsin has a fairly high proportion of rural areas. And that's true no matter which of these definitions you use. In the census definition, I believe it's about 40% of the land area is considered rural. So that's a fairly high proportion.
And we'll get into some other measures, but these definitions get important when we're setting policy, economic, federal policy, state policy, and also trying to understand voters and cultural behavior, right?
Yeah, that's right. There's been a lot of attention recently, of course, on voting behavior in rural places, but the reason all these definitions exist is because lots of federal and state programs offer services based on the economic characteristics, the social and socioeconomic characteristics of the people who live in places. And those really do vary based on urban and rural designations.
And as you write in the piece, it's more complicated than some of these official definitions. For example, it might mean something different if you're in a rural county, say, 50 miles from Madison versus a rural county in northern Wisconsin, much, much further from a larger city.
That's right. So one of the issues, in fact, one of the definitions that we talk about is access to basic services and access to specialty services. So it's, as you say, it's one thing to be within a relatively short driving distance of a major metropolitan area such as Madison or Milwaukee. And it's another thing to be, you know, 90 minutes away from a major metro area where you could access specialty services like cancer treatment, for example.
And this is something that could have serious health impacts that we need to understand.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the reasons that I'm interested in this as a social epidemiologist is because it does relate to health outcomes. In particular, one of the studies I'm working on looks at access to primary care in rural parts of Wisconsin.
Another measurement that you look at is you look at people in a community and maybe the population density, but also where they commute to. Is this a low population density area that where everybody commutes to Milwaukee, or is it a place where maybe they commute to the next small town over?
Right. So in one of the definitions that we look at in this report, you do see differences between some parts of Wisconsin have low population density and really a lot of agriculture or forest area that we might consider rural, just looking at it on a local level. But if you look at commuting patterns, those places really are economically tied to either a major metro or a smaller town. So there are some differences there in terms of how people commute.
Talking to Malia Jones from the Applied Population Lab, trying to figure out what it means to be rural in Wisconsin. What is a rural community? There are a lot of ways to measure it and lots of different meanings depending on how you look at it. And Malia, if we're coming with a question that a lot of people have been asking since last year's elections, how do we better understand rural voters? Well, is there such a thing, given all these different things that we would consider rural? Can we say there's such a thing as a rural voting community?
Well, I do think it's important to look carefully at what we mean by rural when we think about rural voters. A lot of this narrative at the national level has been coming out of pretty urban places. For example, the New York Times has covered this story. And I think that a lot of times those sources just look at the difference between what's happening in major metros and everything else. And the truth is there's a lot of variation in that everything else from places that are truly remote, like the northernmost counties in Wisconsin, to places that are actually relatively good-sized cities, up to 10,000 people. And so the main point here, I guess, is that there is it's complex, and rural is really a multidimensional concept. So thinking about rural voters, you have to take that under consideration.
I wanted to get into another couple of measures. I assume these are not official ones, but the deer per human and the cow per human ratios as a way to measure rural communities.
Yeah, so we asked a few of the extension educators what they thought rural meant to them. And one of the responses we got from Iowa County suggested that one of the metrics we could consider is that they have more cows than people. And so I started wondering, well, do they have more cows than people? And what other parts of Wisconsin do? So we found these data on the number of cattle per county in Wisconsin and made this, I think, really cool map of the cows per person, which are higher. There are more cows than people in a substantial part of southern and eastern Wisconsin where there's a lot of dairy farming. And then I also wanted to include deer per person ratios because in the northern counties where it's highly forested, deers actually outnumber cattle.
And I should mention, we have a link to this WisContext article that has all these maps visualizing this data. You can check that out again on the Central Time Facebook page. One more measure I wanted to get into, the cow and deer thing reminds me, is of economic types as a way to measure what is rural. What do we look at when we think of main sources of economies for a local area?
So I think the map that we included that speaks most directly to that is the major land uses, and this is a really richly detailed map that comes from the Department of Natural Resources, actually, and it gives a major land use for each really small little tile of Wisconsin. It provides this rich portrait of which parts of the state are agricultural, which parts are forested, and which parts are urbanized, as well as a few other major land uses. And those really do speak directly to the economic activity in those places. So obviously places that are agricultural lands are reliant on farming as well as dairy and cattle.
And one more measure, and this is one that's probably harder to map, is not the number of people or the economic numbers, but how people feel about it. We've talked to Kathy Kramer about rural Wisconsin in the past, and you mentioned her work there. What would be involved in trying to track what that means?
To put the sort of social markers of rurality on a map is a real challenge that I would be up for. I'm not really sure how you would measure it exactly, but it is Kathy Kramer's main point that rural is not so much a place as it is an identity. And so you really have to look at how the people self-identify and how they feel about their own communities as well as more urbanized places.
So you've looked at these different ways of measuring rural communities, and you've got these great visualizations. What are you hoping people do with them?
I'm hoping that people can take a more nuanced view of what rural America, and in particular the Rust Belt states, including Wisconsin, really look like and the challenges that are faced in those places, and try to understand better the recent election outcome, as well as more generally the economic needs of rural places.
Malia, thanks a lot, excuse me, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Malia Jones, social epidemiologist with the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Lab. Again, we've got that report at wiscontext.org. We have a link, a lot of great data visualizations there, a lot of great maps over at the Central Time Facebook page.
If you had to guess how many museums are in Wisconsin, what would you pick? Well, it's hard to get an exact number, but estimates are between 300 and 500, and they're in just about all parts of the state and house collections that include almost anything you can think of.
It's Wisconsin Museum Week now, devoted to exploring the diversity and range of Wisconsin's many museums.
Greg Vadney is executive director of the Rahr West Art Museum in Manitowoc and is the vice president of the Wisconsin Federation of Museums. Greg, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So you are, as we said, the executive director at the Rahr West Art Museum in Manitowoc. Tell us about the Rahr West Art Museum. What would we find there?
I'll give you a little bit. You know, we have a little bit of everything, hopefully a microcosm of what Wisconsin has. The Rahr West was established actually by the city of Manitowoc. We're a public museum. And we've got a late 19th century Victorian house, the Vilas Rahr Mansion, which is on the National Register of Historic Places. But we also have a really, really solid, actually one of Wisconsin's best 20th century art collections with a lot of kind of well-known national and international names, George O'Keefe, Andy Warhol, Andrew Wyeth, Picasso. So a really phenomenal collection. And because it's Wisconsin and we kind of like to do things maybe a little screwy, we also happen to be the site of a crash landing in 1962 of the Soviet Sputnik 4 spacecraft.
Whoa. So how does that factor in as a museum exhibit?
Great question. It actually crash landed directly in front of the museum, and it was a museum at the time of the crash landing. So, you know, we've worked with NASA through the years and have a little vignette that tells the story. But, boy, it almost seems like we have to shoehorn a bunch of different stories into the one museum.
Yeah, a lot
going on. And really,
that's
indicative of a lot of historic sites and museums throughout the state.
And part of the point of Wisconsin Museum Week is that we get to know museums that we didn't know about, and also think about intentionally the role, the link between the community and the museum. And in your case, at Rahr West Art Museum in Manitowoc, what would you say that role is? How does it fit into the community?
Well, because we're a public museum, we are directly mission-driven to serve every member of our community. And one of my favorite things about the Rahr West, when we bring youth groups, kids from our neighbors, our community here into the Rahr West, I get the opportunity to ask them, who owns the art here? And the answer legitimately here at the Rahr West as a public museum is that they do. I love to tell these kids, you guys own this Picasso. You guys own this. Now, a bunch of other people do, so you can't walk it out the door. But it's a really phenomenal thing, and especially in a town as small as Manitowoc.
Hmm. Well, as we were saying before, it may be surprising to some people that there are actually hundreds of museums in Wisconsin, because typically I think we associate museums with a few, maybe a handful of really high-profile museums, but there are so many more than that. Can you give us a sense of the range of the different museums that we find in Wisconsin?
It is a huge range, and when we talk about museums, I think it's always important to include, under the umbrella of museums, the zoos, aquariums, that are throughout the state. So it's not just what you would think of as, say, Milwaukee Art Museum or the Public Museum down there, or the Children's Museum in Madison, some of these larger institutions, like you said. There are a number of small, maybe one or two-person staff museums throughout the state, and some volunteer-driven museums throughout the state. You've got ones in the Northwest dedicated to logging, and then you've got ones that are dedicated to the great diversity of populations in the more urban areas.
So why do you think a week like this is important to stop and think about what's there and how it serves Wisconsin?
Well, one, it's a great opportunity for museums to do something special to engage their communities, whether it's discounted or free admission, whether it's collaboration between local museums. But also, it's a great opportunity to talk to our local leaders, our statewide leaders, even our national leaders, to advocate for the benefits of that come with museums. Beyond that, really, though, the advocacy comes to telling the people in our neighborhoods, the people in our communities, what museums do for them. First of all, we are in many ways caretakers of our collective community heritage here in Wisconsin. But we also, for a museum like mine, hold the keys to great deals of art, and also we're able to be a place where our local artists have a venue to show their work.
You know, if someone isn't particularly used to visiting museums, and I'm talking about museums of any stripe here, from the incredible Milwaukee Art Museum to maybe a small museum along Lake Michigan devoted to boating. I mean, if they're not used to visiting, this can be intimidating to sort of think about what the etiquette might be and what the fee might be and how you kind of comport yourself in a museum. And sometimes that can keep people away. What do museums need to do to keep the doors open and to educate about that?
Well, I love that you mentioned that, because in the museum world, we're always worried about the stigma of being a mansion on the hill. And my museum is actually a mansion on a hill. So we are acutely aware that there are many communities of people who not only are underserved by museums, but don't feel like they belong. And part of what we try to do here at the Rahr West is open the doors up with maybe some quirkier events, like celebrating that crash landing of Sputnik, that kind of take the stigma out of an art museum. One of my favorite quotes came from a person that was visiting here during Sputnik Fest, and they were walking through the art galleries, and they said, you know, I never thought I really belonged in a place like this. Hmm. And it was sad to hear that, but also wonderful to hear that from somebody using the past tense. And that's part of what we need to do as museums, is not make people think that we are kind of a stuffy mansion on the hill, that we are a place where the communities that we live in and work in can gather to discuss either issues of the day and how they relate to our past, or be inspired by some of the things that we exhibit.
We're talking with Greg Vadney right now, executive director of the Rahr West Art Museum in Manitowoc, and he's the vice president of the Wisconsin Federation of Museums. And Greg, you were talking about someone who said they never felt like they belonged in a museum. What changed in that particular incident, and what can be translated to other museums who might have a tougher time sometimes making that shift? Because I think if you look at, in the past, there are museums who have done outreach exceptionally well, and there are museums who have had a little more of that, you know, mansion on the hill, don't touch anything aspect. And it seems to me that we're moving into an era where we want to be inclusive of everybody in every community while respecting the space that we're in and the things that are there. But how do we bridge that divide?
Yeah, and in many ways, we're also in a much more democratic or populist time period where people have a lot more freedom of choice. And for us in the museum world, we need to adapt to that situation. I think the biggest thing is listening. Museums really do invest a lot of money in doing museum surveys or focus groups so they can touch not only the people that are coming in their doors, but start to reach out and figure out who's not coming in our doors and why. And I think museums individually do that, and I think in some of the larger organizations, we're compelled to do that kind of study. And what it comes down to for a place like us, in a small community like Manitowoc, about 35,000 people, is to make sure that we're listening to our community, that we're not stuck with the doors shut, just worried about things. Because a lot of times in the museum world, we get worried about our collections, get worried just about the things, and forget about the people. And for us, a lot of times, it's about swinging our doors open and not just inviting people in, but getting out into our communities and listening to them.
And so going forward, we've got Wisconsin Museums Week. What do you want people to keep in mind when they visit? And maybe they're listening now, and maybe they'll be encouraged to visit for the first time a museum in their community. What should they know about what to expect when they go, and how to engage with what's there?
Yeah, I think engage is the right word. I think maybe the best thing to say is participate in museums. Museums are pretty good at allowing people to not just look, listen, but also to kind of engage what they're seeing, to think critically about it, and to react to it. And I think if people have an opportunity, this is a great week to go out and find a new museum. And I can tell you that statewide, wherever your listeners are, they might be surprised at how many museums are right around the corner to them. For instance, I was talking a few months ago with our Congressman, Glenn Grossman, and he asked me how many museums are in my congressional district. And I didn't know offhand, so I did the research and found that he, in his congressional district, in our congressional district, which is the sixth, we have 70 museums that I could find. And together, those 70 museums have over a million visitors each year. So it really was surprising to me, and I'm on the board of directors for the state association. So I think people will be surprised at how many museums are right around their neighborhood, and each one of them telling a very unique and special story.
Greg, thanks so much for joining us today.
It was great to be on.
Greg Vadney is executive director of the Rahr West Art Museum in Manitowoc and vice president of the Wisconsin Federation of Museums. And he joined us to talk about Wisconsin Museum Week, which is going on right now.
A big story in the heart of the American capital has captured national attention as a historic site adds a new addition in an effort to make way for ducklings.
families of ducks have moved into the Capitol reflecting pool, but the sloping, slippery limestone sides of the pool have made it kind of tricky for ducklings to get in and get out.
The solution, the Capitol architect added two small duck ramps to the pool. The ramps will allow the nation's ducklings to get in and out of the pool safely and easily.
So that's good news for ducks. Some bad news maybe for the ducks now. The ramps have a warning to D.C. tourists. It says, do not feed the ducks. So open access to the reflecting pool, good, but no free lunch for the ducks.
On Twitter, the U.S. Capitol account has released video of the ramps in action. I guess the ducklings, you know, you see a bunch of them. A few of them make it in, a few are struggling. I mean, ramps, you know, they're not natural. They're not second nature for ducklings, but they'll get there. They're able to get in and out now.
It's very thoughtful, isn't it, that they put a ramp in for ducklings?
Well,
I bet tourists were gathered around going,
exactly.
Oh, another one fell.
That's what I was thinking. If they didn't do something, like, there'd be hordes of D.C. tourists, like, looking, calling the police department or, I don't know, the White House, asking for intervention to help the ducklings.
Right. So, no one wants to see a duckling fall on its little fuzzy bottom.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.